This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Enterprise Biz Bytes, also known as Valentine's Day. My name is Rich Bradbury, in the studio with
Arvind Yuvraj
and Christine Wong.
Quietly hiding in the corner is Audrey Raj as well. She's going to pretend she's not there, but I know she's giggling right now and looking at me slyly. There we go. Right. Thank you, Sabrina, for the news. Of course, we are going to be with you all the way through until 1 o'clock this afternoon. Stories that we will be covering. Drones that can dodge obstacles. That is terrifying. Christine has a CNY ad roundup for us a little bit later on. Arvind will be talking about America's answer to the gender pay gap and how the BBC, not related story, BBC are to ban single-use plastics by 2020, wrapping up with Bill Gates and science. So if you want to get in touch with the show today, as per usual, 018-789-8899 is the number on WhatsApp. And of course, we are on Twitter at BFM Radio. So artificially intelligent drones are coming, and they're going to be shooting some really interesting stuff. A startup called Skydio, they are launching the first drone capable of visually imprinting on a person, a bit like a needy duckling, and then following him or her around, deftly navigating around trees, pylons, and other obstacles whilst shooting video. In other words, your very own robotic airborne paparazzo. Right?
See, you say like a little duckling, and I think of the bee robots from Black Mirror.
Right.
That's really what I'm going for.
So this new drone, it's called R1, not R2, will be marketed as an easy way to capture action like biking, skiing, or rafting in high-quality video. The founder of Skydio says his company is thinking about how it could be used to inspect roofs for damage and to patrol properties. Yeah, I'm sure he is. So aerial vehicles are already being used to inspect buildings, perform security patrols, and tally inventory inside warehouses. But to navigate a complex and unfamiliar environment, a drone typically needs to be controlled by an expert pilot on the ground, or else its surroundings might be mapped in great detail. So it uses deep learning to recognize a person. It employs conventional methods for mapping and navigation, along with a mathematical approach to path planning that they've been working on. Flying drones are harder to perfect than self-driving cars. Mapping the environment and planning a path must be done in three dimensions rather than two, and drones typically cannot carry much in the way of computing power. So the idea behind this is, you know, it's really simple. This drone that follows you around is whatever you want. And then I gave a link to you two guys of a little Black Mirror-ish kind of story called Slaughterbots, which is effectively mini drones that follow you around and have the capability of killing people.
Yes, I suppose, tiny, you know, explodey drones.
Right. So the idea is that all of these little things, the idea that a drone can fly itself, it can film somebody, it can recognize somebody via AI and mapping and one thing or another. We have all of this technology already, and it's not, I don't see it being too long before some wonderful military company comes along and says, you know what, we could use these for a whole bunch of things.
Yeah, I mean, every single new development in technology pretty much can be used for nefarious purposes if someone gets their hands on it.
And we know they will.
Yeah, right? So I'm kind of, you know, I don't like that it's happening, but I don't really know what can be done to stop this happening, because no matter what innovation you can come up with, everything can kind of be used for evil.
Right. Go on.
It's, but yeah, but that's what we think. But then it always ends up like someone's going to use this to do their YouTube vlogs and stuff, like a daily thing. Like it's going to follow them around. It's going to be a new way for them to not hold like a selfie stick and stuff. Because we have like, we always get like technology to like fly cars, and then we send cars into space playing David Bowie and things like that.
You're right.
But it's never for, I don't know, it never amounts to like the worst case scenario.
Right.
I hope it doesn't, but it can.
I mean, I like the idea of it. I mean, let's think about, okay, take the paparazzi idea away, but let's say you're a news agency and you're working on a story and you're trying to follow a particular politician, you want to get his points of view, and you feed it the data about this politician, and zzz, off it goes and it starts filming that politician and getting his, you know, views and whatnot. I think that could be really interesting and, of course, incredibly invasive. But yeah. I like the idea of it.
Yeah. It also helps. I guess I'm also interested to see how it'll do with documentaries and stuff. Because we can't get, you know, like wildlife and things like that. You can't get close enough. But then you send a drone in and then it goes into places that you cannot go, into caves and into jungles, into forests. I don't know. I'm not so worried about the implications of it killing people, because I think there is technology like that already. And then we just aren't aware. And then you have more frightening things like people putting cameras into pens and onto like small tiny holes in walls
right.
that you cannot even detect.
That are advertised on Instagram, you know, just scrolling through your feed, yes.
Yeah, you can even see it pop up on like e-commerce stores, like even online stores and stuff. I think those are more frightening than, you know, having actual drones that can follow people around. Because I don't know, I just see it being something harmless, like it could just help people make their own movies and things.
And
like
I think it's going to be a passing fad as well, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little, tiny little drone that just pops out of your pocket, you flick it up and, you know, you're doing a little Wi-Fi and a selfie and a small little vlog.
Mm. Yeah. You know it's going to be so. Like, you're going to be able to walk past, like, Pasamalam and someone's going to be, like, demonstrating it and you can just pick it up. The cheap version you can pick up for maybe, like, $25 and then go about having your selfies taken and things.
Yeah. All right, let's take a short break. A quick advertisement coming up. When we come back, we will be speaking about some Chinese New Year ads that Christine has got lined up for us. Don't go anywhere. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Barry fronts Motown. BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're back on Enterprise BizBytes on BFM 89.9. Just before the break, we were speaking about these drones that can follow you around by imprinting on your face. That sounds wrong, but you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to get in touch, if you think this is a good idea or a bad idea, let us know. We're on Twitter, of course, at BFM Radio, and on WhatsApp, 018-789-8899. It's not only Valentine's Day, but of course we have Chinese New Year coming up very, very shortly. Christine's been looking at some of the CNY ads and is going to give us a little bit of a roundup.
I mean, to be fair, it was kind of difficult to miss the CNY ads this year, but here are some of the more kind of notable ones that I'd like to talk about. Obviously, Apple has released a long ad that puts tears before cheers. It's based on a true story, and it basically sums up the concept of what if your Chinese New Year was only 3 minutes long, with this train conductor who can only see her son for 3 minutes on the platform before she has to continue her job. Now, what people were a little bit confused about was how this was actually an Apple ad, because it just seemed to tug on the heartstrings and make you cry. And the idea of it is that it's meant to be advertising the iPhone X. However, the only overt role the phone plays is that the man behind the camera, who is famed movie director Peter Chan, shot the whole ad on the iPhone X. That's the idea of it, right? But I feel like, I don't know, it's for me personally, I didn't actually realize that that was the case when I saw it. I was just too busy, you know, sobbing in the corner like a small child. But it has done very well, despite the sadness, or perhaps because of it. The ad has actually enjoyed considerable attention in China. And as of last week, it's already enjoyed 68 million online views.
Holy smoke.
Yes, and that was last week. I don't actually know the number for this week yet. And first figures suggest that the iPhone X has had a very good start in the Chinese market, and it's become the top-selling phone in urban China as well. So Apple is you know, they're really targeting the right market here, because if there's one place where they want to succeed, it's China, right? So the next ad that I have is Mercedes-Benz. Now, Mercedes-Benz, their current Chinese New Year spot runs with this hashtag of passed down tradition. And they just, it's a typical, you know, trip down memory lane where they this protagonist learns about the various traditions associated with Chinese culture. But the reason why it's interesting is because it's a kind of, they're trying to make up for the fact that their 2017 Chinese New Year ads were not received very well. Some called last year's ads terrible, meaningless, low class, and a waste of money. Because
just
of its,
say what you think.
Yeah, yeah. Because of its lackluster narrative, which is just that a couple are sitting in a car talking about the protagonist's strained relationship with his brother. Then a parking spot opens up. Using park assist, the lady parks her car. Then step out the car, man sees his brother. Chinese music, yay. So that was last year's one. So this year's one is a little bit more emotional, a little bit more sticking to tradition. However, while the quality of the film has improved, a lot of people are saying that it didn't quite strike the right notes and it still doesn't provide the human elements that it needed to actually get a lot of attention. Then the next thing I have is from Tanaka National, which I actually was a bit confused by, because I didn't, I was kind of like, everyone uses you. Why are you putting out ads? But it's fine. I actually really liked their ad this year. It's set against a multicultural neighborhood with a bit of nostalgia. It's a little short film called Coming Together. And the idea is that it encourages viewers to uphold tradition and to celebrate Chinese New Year with everyone around you. Although technology is important, it can't replace the real life bond that we can foster with the people around us. Next up is Air Asia. This one I quite liked as well, because it was a little bit of a twist on the typical, you know, reunion story. It's actually told from a dog's perspective, because this year is the year of the dog. So it's a nice little ad that takes a new twist on the typical Chinese New Year ad story. And the message of the ad is just that the ties that bind us lead us home, which, you know, helps with the whole Air Asia thing of flying and the thing, and it's all great. My favorite, though, my favorite ad of Chinese New Year 2018 is the Maxis ad, because the Maxis ad this year interviews the lion from the Lion Dance that you see wandering around the streets and in various homes and stuff. And he talks about how he's exhausted trying to run around to every single house for Chinese New Year, which is hilarious. But in line with that, which I find really interesting, Maxis created this specific ang pao called the Huat A ang pao. So Huat is kind of like fortune and prosperity. But A, even though it's also a suffix, also stands for augmented reality. So you can download an app with this ang pao, this special ang pao, and it creates a little augmented reality lion dance for you.
Brilliant.
So good, so entertaining and unique, and just a nice fun time for the whole family.
Great stuff, yeah.
It's I think the iPhone 10 one stands out the most because it's so it's advertising on a whole different level, because they never advertise the iPhone, they never show the iPhone even once, and it doesn't, you know, a lot of ads like a lot of Chinese New Year ads like to use like very stereotypical imagery, like you have the lion dance, and then you have like, they always have that kung fu kind of parody that shows up and people doing things like that imitate.
They just shove it in your face.
Yeah, they just shove it in your face. It's funny at times, but sometimes it's overdone. You know, people doing like kung fu stunts and like jumping up, and sometimes it gets a little bit offensive as well. The iPhone X one is like far beyond that. They don't show anything that's stereotypically Chinese New Year. They don't show any imagery that even relates to Chinese New Year. It's just life in China and how some people have to work during the holiday, and how they get only very like limited amount of time with their family. And it's nothing about the iPhone. It's just shot on the iPhone. And then we just keep talking about it like, oh, this was shot on the iPhone and it's so cinematic and blah, blah, blah. And I like the AirAsia one because of the dog, because it's a completely different perspective.
All right, we have to wrap up. Music coming up after some ads. And when we get back, we'll be talking about America's answer to the gender pay gap. We've been talking about this for the last week or so. More updates on that. In the meantime, some Lemonheads coming up with Mrs. Robinson here on Enterprise Biz Bytes on BFM 89.9.
Bankers, financiers, and moneymakers. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to Enterprise Biz Bytes. My name is Rich Bradbury. I'm joined in the studio by
Christine Wong,
Arvind Yuvraj.
All the way till 1 o'clock, we'll be with you on this Valentine's Day. Of course, we started off with stories about how little drones can follow you around, dodge obstacles, and do all of that kind of clever stuff. We then had a quick roundup of some of the Chinese New Year ads, and Christine was saying that your favorite one was the Maxis one, I believe.
Yeah, the Huat A app.
The Huat A. And then now we're moving on to something we've been discussing quite a bit over the last week or so about gender pay gaps, and we started off last week, it might have even been this week, no, last week, with the Tesco pay gap we spoke about and a few others. Now America have said they think they have the answer to the gender pay gap, or at least a suggestion.
They think they do.
Right.
So what they want to do is they want to bar employers from asking job applicants what they currently earn, so that the new salary that they offer isn't based on their previous figure. So this law is already in effect in places like California, Massachusetts, New York, and Puerto Rico, and it's under consideration in more than 20 other states, as well as on a national level. The logic behind this is to stop a hiring practice that some people say perpetuates the pay gap, since women often start out with lower salaries. So according to government statistics, on average, women in the U.S. earn about 80% of the amount paid to men. For Black and Hispanic women, the gap is even wider than that. So some of the difference is due to factors like occupation or part-time work. But according to research by the American Association for University Women, women who are just 1 year out of college earn 7% less than men, and that gap keeps widening over time, because every employer bases a person's pay according to what they earned previously, and women always earn less in every job. So they start out with a lower pay, and then when every time they skip a job and then they go to a new job, that person just pays them based on what they earned before. So they are never able to catch up, and is never equal. So the men keep getting paid more and more and more, because their salaries are also based on what they earned before, and the same thing happens to women. So it never catches up. The gap just stays the same.
Stays wider.
Yeah. So like I said, because this 7% less gap, the cycle keeps continuing again and again and again. A study by the human resources consulting firm Korn Ferry says that about 95% of more than 100 large and mid-sized employers asked about candidates' pay histories. Companies normally offer about 10% above someone's current pay. And in some cases, she says companies also use salaries to screen candidates, and they interpret high pay as a proxy for competence and responsibility.
There's a little quote here that I really like. This is from Katie Donovan, I believe, who she pushed a law She pushed to include the ban on prior pay queries in this Massachusetts law. And the quote is, the dirty little secret in hiring mm-hmm. is, for the most part, we pay people what they're willing to accept.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So they also found, they did some research and they found that women are less likely to negotiate for their salaries. And even when they do, they're less likely to get what they negotiate for. So they say that that's the problem with this. It could come to a point where companies just, they don't base it on your previous salary, but then they ask you what you think you're worth. And if you say something that's less than what they're willing to pay, then they're just going to pay you that less amount. And it could come to a point where they're just going to look at you and pay you less anyway, if you're a woman. So that problem hasn't been addressed yet. That could be a challenge in the future. Employers could just look at someone and go, okay, you're a woman, so I'm just going to pay you less. So they're not exactly sure how this is going
to
work.
Yeah, I was about to say, you know, if they're not basing your new salary on what your old salary was, what are they basing it on? Because the interview process is so short. You know, you send in an application, a cover letter, you go in, you meet them maybe once, twice, three times, mm-hmm. and then they have to judge how much they have to pay you based off what information. Do you know what I mean? If it's not your previous salary. So I feel like maybe it might have to have, like, the interview process might have to include maybe like a week of shadowing or something where they can see exactly how well you do at the job. Something like that, where it's definitely skills-based. Mm. But then I don't know how efficient that would be as for a lot of companies, and especially companies with like a really high turnover rate. I'm not really sure how that would work. I do, however, like the attempt at trying to fix the problem, because the fact of the matter is it's so difficult to answer that question when you're in an interview and someone says, okay, well, how much do you think you should be paid? Mm-hmm. And oftentimes, you know, you don't even know what to judge that on. It's like, do I judge that from what my peers are saying in kind of the same hierarchy level? But do I also judge it by industry? Do I judge it by this? Do I judge it by that? So I don't know. I like the fact that they're trying really hard with this, but I feel like really the main way to do this is just don't discriminate against people based on gender. But that's just like, it's so much easier said than done.
Yeah. I don't know. I think that's a bad habit that employers have. You shouldn't ask someone what they think they should be paid.
I agree.
Yeah. You should have an amount that you are willing to pay them. Yeah. And then you should put that on the table first. And then they should be able to go, do I want to accept this or not? Or do I feel that I'm worth more? Was I earning more in my previous job? Mm. Should I accept this? Or, you know, is it worth my time? Right. You can't ask someone because they're not in that job. They haven't done it yet. So why would they even know like where to start? You know, you can't say, just say I'm worth like what, you put down a sum and then the work that you give them is so much more than that sum is worth, right? Mm-hmm. They're saying that this logic is basically just to pay people according to who they are on based on the job and not who the person is. But it's going to take like a few years of job switching and people going into like new companies to see if this actually works out. Because like I said, the biggest problem with this is it opens up the discussions for how much you should get paid. If you open up that discussion and then the company feels they don't want to pay you that much, then it just comes back to, you know, the drawing board, the square one. Mm. Yeah. And then if you do open up discussions and then you say an amount that's lower, then does the company be honest and like offer you more? Or do they come up and say, no, we were willing to pay you like a couple of thousand extra? Mm. Or do they just like keep quiet and just keep going on with you getting paid less?
Yeah, and especially because women are socially conditioned to not be as assertive as men are as well. You know, you're meant to be like polite and not say anything and refuse the last cookie or whatever, right? You're not, the whole point is that you're not supposed to, quote unquote, you know, ask for more than you deserve. Whereas a lot of men are conditioned to just be like, okay, I'm going to ask for the most that I can get. So that kind of social, you know, limit.
Do you think that still applies though?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yes. The thing is, it is getting better. And I think a lot of people are getting, you know, a lot more assertive. But I feel that also, especially when you think about Asia specifically, those gender dynamics are still very much so in effect.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that.
So that is really where I'm concerned about, is the fact that, you know, regardless of it improving, those structures are still in place.
Do you think that's because of this problem itself? So it's like a cyclical thing, because, you know, women start out getting paid less, and then when you get paid less, you don't want to negotiate because that's the best that they think they can get. So it's a kind of toxic cycle.
It's a vicious cycle,
vicious cycle that
started
out there.
I would definitely agree with that,
yeah,
for sure. So I think maybe it might be useful maybe for people to be educated about what they're actually worth. Like, what does that mean? What skills can you value at a certain amount? That would be, I think, very, very helpful for everyone.
All right. We have to take a short break. We've got music coming up from Suede with the Beautiful Ones, some ads, and then when we come back, of course, we're talking a little bit about how the BBC are to ban single-use plastics by 2020, all thanks to a TV presenter. Don't go anywhere. You listen to Enterprise Biz Bytes on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Best flipping moments. BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Welcome back to Enterprise Biz Bytes. Our next story about how the BBC are to ban single-use plastics by 2020. Right, so each year, 400 million tons of plastic is produced, and 40% of it is single-use, meaning it's only used once before being thrown away. More than 8 million tons of plastic enter the world's seas each year, with most of that coming from land. The BBC are set to ban the single-use plastics after the TV series Blue Planet 2 highlighted the scale of sea pollution. If you didn't already know, Blue Planet 2, narrated, of course, by Sir David Attenborough, was the most viewed TV show of 2017. Its first episode attracted more than 14 million viewers. Mm-hmm. So the Director General of the BBC, Tony Hall, has said that he had been shocked by the plastic waste featured in last year's Nature documentary. 2 million plastic cups are currently used by BBC visitors and staff annually. The decision comes after the Queen backed efforts to reduce single-use plastics on Britain's royal estates. The Scottish Parliament also announced plans to ban plastic straws, following similar announcements by restaurants including Pizza Express, Wagamama, and JD Weatherspoon. Now, we're now at that stage where if it wasn't for David Attenborough, we would not be the BBC would not be banning plastic single-use plastic cups and stuff.
I'd also like to point out that Al Gore must be feeling real salty about all of this. He's been warning us for years.
Yeah, he just doesn't have that voice, though.
And David Attenborough just calmly is like, there's so much plastic in the ocean. Please fix it. And then now the BBC is listening. So that's all good, right?
No, I mean, that show is so well done and it's so hyper-produced and the way that they show. I don't know how they get some of the shots that they get.
An absolute fortune.
Yeah.
I was going to say magic, but that too.
Yeah. It looks like magic because some of the shots they get, especially the one of the, I don't know if it's the same documentary, but something by the BBC, the one where the iguana is being chased by the...
It is.
The
yes.
Yeah, yeah, same thing. So I have no idea. So the shots that they get, I think they got shots of the pollution that it caused and just things that people have not seen before, because sometimes seeing is believing, right? Mm. So I think once they saw the images of the animals that suffer because of the plastic and the amount of plastic that I think they are specifically talking about, where there's one island, I forgot where it is, there's plastic that washes up on its shores because of where it's located in the ocean,
right?
Yeah, and it's just an island full of plastic, nothing else, and it's shocking to see.
I mean, that image that we've seen floating around of a seahorse gripping onto a an earbud. Have you seen that one, right?
Yeah, the little cotton bud.
The little cotton bud. And that's one of those images that will forever stick with me, you know?
Oh. Yeah. For me, it's the one where they're trying to pull out the straw from the tortoise's nose, the nostril. Yeah, and the thing is, I couldn't watch it with sound because I had to mute it because it's screaming and it's making all kinds of noises and they try to like pull a straw out that's so deeply lodged into its head through its nose. So, you know, things like that. I guess sometimes you just have to see images like that to you know, shake you out of your comfort zone and know what's going on the other side of the world that you might not care about at the moment.
I mean, closer to home, the island of Phi Phi, for example, they've been cleaning up a lot of their beaches very recently, and a lot of it has, I mean, because it was quite dirty in places, and the locals are really concerned because there is a very large, very big food chain very shortly moving to Phi Phi. It's the one with the golden arches. Mm-hmm. And the one thing that they are really worried about is the use of plastic straws on Phi Phi Island, because they know for a fact that a whole lot of people will be using that particular restaurant and they'll be throwing their litter everywhere because a lot of them do not care about where they are and what they're doing. Mm-hmm. You know, and so how do you address an issue with the company who is that big? You know,
I think the company themselves are doing something about it. They've been, what is it, like 2025 or something? They want to go like completely biodegradable plastics and they want to use more paper than plastic or something.
Let's hope
that.
So.
Yeah, I think that's one way. I mean, the company itself has to change.
For sure.
I think banning single-use plastic is one thing, but I think people have to do away with plastics altogether. It's like old technology or something that was used out of necessity back then, but we've got so many other alternatives. Mm. I don't know why we still rely on plastics, because whether it's single use or not single use, I think the reason people don't keep using anything plastic is because they're worried about how much of that plastic seeps into their food. So you use a Tupperware, then you microwave it once, and then you throw it away because you don't want to use it again. So it becomes single use. But the fact is, plastic by itself is, you know, it's something that isn't safe or isn't healthy.
Right.
You know what? This Valentine's Day, love the planet.
Oh, yeah.
She goes, love the planet. Please love the WhatsApps and the Twitters, because you can reach us and talk to us about all the stuff we've been talking about at 018-789-8899 or on Twitter at BFM Radio. Send us some love, guys.
She also writes Hallmark cards, you know. Right, we're taking a very short break. It is Enterprise Biz Bytes on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Break from midfield. BFM 89.9.
Almost time for us to wrap up here on Enterprise Biz Bytes. But of course, we've got one more story before we head into lunch. Bill Gates, his advice for the future entrepreneurs, go into science.
Yeah, so one thing that Bill Gates is known to be good at is spotting opportunity. His vision of the emerging opportunities in the world of computers spurred him to drop out of Harvard, Gates said Tuesday in a discussion of his and Melinda Gates' annual letter. As a side note, awesome couple, represent, happy Valentine's Day. The pair talked with Lin-Manuel Miranda at Hunter College on Tuesday and explained that the opportunity to directly improve a huge number of lives determined the Gates Foundation's focus on education and global health. So someone asked Gates a question about what future entrepreneurs should learn about, and he just said, go into science.
Yep.
The more you can learn the science, the more you will see where the opportunity is. Specifically, Bill Gates thinks that people should look at areas of the world where significant innovation is going to be needed in the near future to help humanity deal with coming challenges. So areas like science or programming, biology, energy breakthroughs, those are going to be the biggest source of change. Gates said that the challenges he considers most important include global disease and the need to develop a new energy system for the planet, no matter who tweets about what that is. The answers to his problems will come from scientific research. Personally, Gates said that he was lucky that software engineering grabbed his interest. And he says that if you have an inkling that science grabs you, that is where a lot of the opportunity comes from.
Do you have a big interest in science at school?
No. I mean, I was interested in science, but not the stuff that was taught in school. There was stuff in physics and all. They just, sometimes when you're in the science stream, you're forced to take it, but I had no interest in physics and stuff like that.
See,
No.
Kind of similar. I have always enjoyed science as something very non-academic, because in academia, at least with my experience, I wasn't really encouraged to be excited about science a lot of the time. So while I was interested in it I would read about it outside of school about what they weren't teaching us. I had a book about Albert Einstein, so I read about all of his theories and stuff in a very short form manner, you know, when I was younger, and I loved that. But then I got into physics class and went, I don't understand anything.
I think you've just hit the nail on the head, the two of you there, right there. It's the way in which that knowledge is kind of given to you, right?
Yeah.
If it's boring and dull, you're not going to want to be interested in it at all.
Yeah.
I had some of the best science teachers ever when I was at school, you know, and it led me to do A-levels in chemistry, biology, psychology, and philosophy, because I had teachers who were passionate about it and wanted to teach it in a way that I would walk away from it going, you know, that was inspiring.
Mm. Yeah.
And that's what we need.
Yeah. Most of my science, a lot of where I've picked up stuff on scientifically is from stuff like Vsauce and ASAP Science and School of Life and things like that. So most of my knowledge comes from YouTube, verified YouTube accounts, not just random people mumbling about things. Yeah. But yeah, so not the academic school stuff, but science, like what Christine said, definitely. Yeah,
I remember a friend who had zero interest in any kind of science, and I passed her a copy of Bill Bryson's A Short History of Nearly Everything. Changed her life, you know. She walked out going, I did not realize how interesting this topic was. You just needed somebody to tell you how interesting it was, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Right, science. I want to swear then, but I couldn't. You know, if you've seen that TV show, you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Anyway, we better quickly run through some of the topics that we covered today, of course. We started off with these drones that can kind of dodge obstacles. They can follow you around. They can do all kinds of cool stuff. Very interesting stuff.
Yeah, and then we talked about Chinese New Year 2018 and a little bit of a roundup of the ads from Apple, Mercedes-Benz, Tanaga National, AirAsia, and Maxis.
Yeah, and if you've got, you know, free time this weekend, it's a long weekend, check out these ads. Some of them are, really, really good.
Yeah, you can find them all up on YouTube.
Yeah. We also spoke about America's answer to the gender pay gap. They want to make companies offer people based on the job and not based on their previous salaries.
We then spoke about how the BBC are to ban single-use plastics by 2020. If you get the chance, check out Blue Planet 2, of course. course, narrated by Sir David Attenborough, that might inspire you to kind of cut down your plastic usage a little.
And speaking of which, Bill Gates' advice to future entrepreneurs is to go into science, especially things like science, programming, biology, or energy breakthroughs.
Really interesting stuff. If you missed any part of this show, as per usual, you can download the podcast via the app on the Apple App Store if you use an Apple device, or of course, you can use Google Play to download it from there, and head over to the website, bfm.my/podcasts. Right, don't go anywhere though, because coming up after the 1 o'clock news, it is the Breakfast Grill replay. Housekey, Maybank Islamic's rent-to-own scheme, is the first of its kind in Malaysia that aims to provide an alternative solution for home ownership without any down payment while offering a locked-in purchase price for customers. The Breakfast Grill spoke with Dato Rafiq Merican, CEO of Maybank Islamic Berhad, on the scheme as well as Islamic financing in a global and local perspective. That's all coming up in just a few minutes. After these pieces of music, of course, it is Valentine's Day, so wrapping up with a couple of lovely, lovely love songs. Mm-hmm. We've got the Beatles with All You Need Is Love up next, followed by the Cranberries with Linger. This is BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.